Welcome to The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. Here's your host, Jeff Nadeau.
What's up, everybody, and welcome in to another edition of The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Nadeau. Hope you're having a great night wherever you are. We are back and better than never. Another show, another week, another sit down. Got another huge episode for you today. Let's bring in our co-host, our friend, Blackjack Fletcher. Blackjack, what's good? How you doing, bro? Another week, another show. How's it going?
I'm good, buddy. I'm good. I'm interested to dive into this one. This is one show that I know people have requested for a little while.
Yeah. And, you know, this is, we've done a couple in a row where, you know, they've kind of been ones that I've wanted to do, particularly, you know, like Vinny Asar, I wanted to do. But, you know, I've been wanting to do Russell Bufalino for a long time. You know, obviously, Russell is a guy that, you know, whenever you talk about the mob, you know, history, a lot of people don't bring his name up. You know, and you have these guys that, you know, really at one point were some of the more powerful people in the country. And Russell really was. He had his hand in a lot of different things and really was involved in some of the biggest kind of points in American history at certain points. Plus, he was involved with Jimmy Hoffa. And we're going to talk about that today. Huge show, Russell Bufalino. What, Blackjack, obviously a lot of people know the film The Irishman, but we're going to put a little of that to bed today, and we're just going to talk about the life and times of Russell Bufalino, who at one point, he really was one of the more powerful people, you know, on the East Coast when it comes to the mob.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, obviously, you know, the portrayal in The Irishman is what's going to stick out to a lot of people, but as you mentioned, Russell Bufalino is one of those guys who, you know, if you're talking about traveling outside of the families in New York, you could argue there was a period of time where Russell Bufalino was as powerful as any mafia figure anywhere in the United States.
Yeah. And, you know, we're going to kind of dispel some of the things, you know, about the film, let's say, that were not factual. We've talked about it before. We're going to talk about Frank Sheeran. We're going to talk about Jimmy Hoffa. Yeah, we're going to talk about, you know, really the life and times of Russell today. As always, please follow us on Twitter at the Sit Down 7. Make sure when you listen to the show, if you enjoy it, please leave us a review. Let us know what you think. And make sure you go follow us on YouTube as well, the Sit Down on YouTube. A lot going on, Blackjack. Let's jump right into it. We got a long one today. Let's talk about Russell Bufalino. As always, if you ever have any questions on the show, just reach out to Blackjack or I. Blackjack, do you ever get anyone that reaches out to you?
Yeah. Yeah. We get people that will occasionally contact me about the show. It's always very positive. And, you know, listen, like I said, anyone with any comments, questions, thoughts, feel free anytime.
Yeah, 100%. All right, let's get into it. Russell Bufalino on the sit down. Rosario Alfredo Bufalino was born September 29th, 1903 in Montedoro, Sicily. Montedoro, Blackjack, is about 50 miles from Palermo. And interestingly enough, in 1896, the area around Montedoro actually was big with mines. There were a lot of sulfur mines and that sort of thing. A lot of people were put to work because of those sulfur mines. But in 1896, really towards the end of the 1800s, there was a major issue. The sulfur jobs were kind of getting dried up. The market fell into ruins, and, you know, a lot of people fled. And that's where a lot, if you actually look in the Pittston area up in Pennsylvania, up in the northeastern part of the state, a lot of immigrants from Montedoro were actually coming there and into Buffalo and in the surrounding upstate New York regions. And that would be one of the reasons that Russell Bufalino's father, Angelo, would actually come to America in late 1903. He would actually, as his son was being born, he would actually leave the family in hopes for a better life and went to America. Sadly, though, in early 1904, he would actually die in a mining accident. So Russell Bufalino was left fatherless. Him and his mother and siblings would actually enter the port of New York in 1906. But it actually got worse. In 1910, Russell Bufalino's mother would actually die. He would actually then go back to Sicily and finally would settle in America in 1914 with his brothers. You know, most of, but that, by that point in his life, he was in his, you know, early teens. He would kind of hang out in Buffalo. That's where he first kind of got his start. By the mid to late teens, Russell Bufalino was, you know, just as any mobster is. He was a hood. He was a street kid, stealing, committing crimes, burglaries, things like that. But during all of this, he actually took up a trade. He began learning how to become a mechanic. I guess he felt like at some point he should know some sort of trade. And he, like many blackjack, took to the streets very early. But we talked about this with certain subjects, whether it was, Jimmy Burke or whoever. There are people that were in the mob that, you know, didn't have either parent. And you know, that's hard for any kid. But we can kind of see where someone would go kind of sideways without both parents.
Yeah, I mean, and like really tragic stuff too, right? I mean, like this wasn't, you know, his father, you know, walked out on them or whatever, which is bad enough. But I mean, his father dies in a mining accident, you know, and he never gets to know the man. You know, his mother dies very young. I mean, just tragic stuff. I mean, that's a rough way to start a life, Jeff, with that kind of tragedy on your back.
Yeah. And, you know, if you know anything about Bufalino, his, family was connected to the mob. You know, his brothers were ultimately involved in it. But by 1919, you know, Bufalino's, you know, in his teens, he becomes kind of hooked up with certain people in Buffalo. He starts running around and doing stuff in the early 20s with different Buffalo mobsters. And he catches the attention of a guy called John Montana. John Montana was the underboss of the Buffalo crime family. He also actually hailed from the same town that Bufalino was from, Montadoro. And he started helping with bootlegging things. And Montana took a liking to him, started kind of taking him under his wing and acted as a mentor. And the thing about Buffalo and all these different cities is during Prohibition, they developed a really strong friendship of strong allies through a covert network. And Buffalo and some of the other areas in upstate New York were breeding grounds. I know, you know, there's, you know, reason to believe that Al Capone was involved up there still. They were all kind of covertly connected, if we know anything about the bootlegging network. And this is where also Russell Bufalino would catch the attention of Stefano Magadino, who respected not only the fact that Russell was a tough kid, wasn't a big kid, he was a tough kid. But the thing that people realized pretty quickly about Bufalino is his intelligence. And, you know, when we get into him more of his life, just with who he palled around with, you can understand, you know, he wasn't palling around with low level hoods. He was palling around with Frank Costello, Meyer Lansky, you know, guys with a lot of smarts. And I think early on the network in Buffalo, particularly the underboss and the boss, who were very powerful people in their own right, they really started to respect Russell Bufalino's intelligence. By 1928, you know, Bufalino's making his moves in the underworld. He would meet a woman called Caroline Schiandra. Now, interestingly enough, Schiandra's family was actually in the Sicilian mob. And ultimately, when they would end up moving back to Pittston area, when Russell and her would get married, Russell would actually work directly for her father, who was actually in control of the Northeast Pennsylvania mob at the time. So, you know, Schiandra was very well connected. And she's actually played by Catherine Narducci in the film. You know, she kind of had that that typical spitfire kind of attitude. But she would remain, and Russell would be unfaithful in his life, but she was always kind of the woman that held him down. So Blackjack, Russell Bufalino is, you know, coming from really tough circumstances, but starts to get hooked up with some really powerful people. And I think pretty early on, they respected the intelligence that the kid had.
Yes. I mean, obviously his intelligence is a factor here. You know, he's also, I think, Jeff, in a very, very simple way, like looking for a family, right? I mean, we throw the word family around a lot on this show because, you know, that's what they call themselves. But Russell Bufalino was a man without one. I mean, his father died before he was born. His mother died when he was a few years old. He moved back and forth between Italy and the United States at a time when, you know, that wasn't the easiest thing in the world to do. And now all of a sudden he's falling in with a group of people that like him, that respect him. He's got a girl. He's got, you know, a father type figure. Everything is kind of falling into place for Bufalino at this point.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, obviously he had, you know, no real mother or father or anything. He had a brother or two, but, you know, he needed a family, and I think he kind of found it. By the late 1920s, the Buffalo mob and other families around America are making a lot of money through bootlegging. But by this point, there's another rising star in Buffalo, a guy called Joe Barbara. He basically is summoned by Magadino to go to Northeastern Pennsylvania and kind of run some things over there. He had a kind of a connection to an area called Endicott in New York, which is right over the border. And Barber would be dispatched there to kind of handle operations. Russell Bufalino would ultimately join him and his father-in-law, John Sciandra in Pennsylvania. So Russell and Joe Barber were making inroads over in that area. Obviously, if you know anything about Apalachin, Joe Barber was the individual that they went to his home, obviously, in that 58-acre compound, which we'll get to. But, you know, they're obviously making inroads in the upstate New York and northern Pennsylvania area. And as we know, that's kind of a fertile ground because it's not far from New York. There's obviously many connections you can make down to Philadelphia, to Pittsburgh, up to Buffalo. So there was kind of a good area. Joe Barber would be based in Endicott. And he actually would start kind of getting involved with legit businesses. He would open a Canada Dry plant, basically a soda bottling company. And that's where Russell would have a legit job as a mechanic. And if you've ever seen The Irishman, that's how him and Frank Sheeran supposedly meet, which actually is factual. They would meet that way, actually. So obviously, it actually ended up working because the no-show job or whatever that Russell would initially take. Now, I don't think it was a no-show job initially, but he actually had a legitimate job as a mechanic. By the mid-40s, Russell kind of though starts to build, you know, his own, you know, connections. He starts to build his own life and his own stuff. He obviously has, I think, a lot of people rooting for him, especially Magadino and people like that. He starts kind of building his own empire. And in Northeastern Pennsylvania, obviously, if you know anything about the geography of that area, for many years, it was a coal mining area, right? You know, up in those mountainous areas. Russell decides, though, that he has connections in the garment district in New York City, and he comes up with the idea to start basically creating dress shops and factories. And, you know, he would start creating jobs because, you know, they obviously had a need for dresses and for garments, and he had regular connections right to New York. So he starts opening up all these different dress companies around Northeastern Pennsylvania, and he would ship directly to New York City. He had about a dozen factories, including a place called Alamo Dress Manufacturing and a place called Dixie Frocks Company. All these different factories were obviously low end, but he was making a lot of profit shipping directly to the garment district. And as we know, but the garment district, the mob owned the garment district. So he was branding connections to New York City in other ways. Being so close, he would obviously set up kind of a pipeline. So he was creating jobs. He was doing a lot for the area, and he was making and starting to make a lot of money in that area.
Yeah. And if you think about it, Jeff, it's probably a great spot to set up, right? Because, I mean, I don't have to tell you about the geography, but you've got the Pennsylvania markets. You've got the Western New York market. You're close enough to New York City that, you know, you can be there anytime you need to, and you can still have those connections, like you mentioned, in the Garment District, Diamond District, whatever you need, but you don't have the heat that comes with New York City, right? You don't have the attention that comes with New York City. You're kind of on the back burner. So, like, in a lot of ways, this is a great setup.
Yeah, it really was. And that's exactly what Bufalino did. He started obviously making the inroads due to his connections. But what he started doing is he started spending some time in New York City. He would open a restaurant called Vesuvio in Manhattan. He also would own some dress shops in Manhattan, plus jewelry stores that were in the Diamond District. And this is where he would become close with people like Vito Genovese, Frank Costello. Russell Bufalino was making his presence felt throughout the area. And, you know, it actually would end up working throughout the 40s. The problem, though, would come in the late 40s. Workers began to realize that they were being treated poorly, and the big guy up top was making all the money. So a woman comes to the area through one of the high-end unions in the New York State area and tries to unionize the different workers. And she would become successful, this woman, Min Matheson. By 1953, it was said that she had about 60 different dress shops unionized. And she was making a problem because she was cutting into some of the issues and stuff that Bufalino was making. And he didn't want his people to unionize. He wanted them to be under his control. And that's pretty much it. She would over the decade or so of dealing with Buffalino, she actually became kind of a thorn in his side. He would lean on her. He would have certain people in her family beat up and attacked, even someone killed. But she never wavered. She was a pretty brave woman. And, you know, as I said, by 1953, she had unionized most of the shops up there. But, you know, ultimately, Russell Buffalino would power through. And look, he was making a lot of money regardless, because by this point, and by the mid-50s, Russell Buffalino really owned every facet of the underworld in northeastern Pennsylvania. And if you wanted to operate a bar or pinball machine or bookmaking or extortion or loans or whatever, Russell Buffalino had a piece of everything. And obviously, he was paying off people through bribes and payoffs and that sort of thing. He is another one that realized, the more people I control, the more operations I can create. And up in those areas, as you said, you're not as plugged into to having huge police forces and things of that nature. You know, you look at that Wilkes-Barre, Scranton, Pittston area, you know, there are a lot smaller areas. It's a lot easier to control things up there.
It is. And at the same time, Jeff, the money's just as green, right? I mean, it doesn't matter, you know, whether you're running rackets in a giant place or you've got, you know, 10 small ones. At the end of the day, the money's the money. They're easier to control. There's less police involvement. There's less competition. It's just kind of an easier setup if you think about it in all facets. So Buffalino at this point is kind of set up really, really well.
Yeah, and what was happening also is as we know with mob families, you know, they start stretching out. And obviously he had many connections in Buffalo and to Joe Barber, but you know, he started operating in other parts of Pennsylvania. He had a group down in Hazleton, which is an area not far from that area. He had an individual called Aldo Magnelli, who actually was running gambling and bookmaking and other stuff in Harrisburg. And Blackjack, interestingly enough, I did some research and found that even in where I live in the Lancaster area, there were bars and all sorts of different places that were connected to the Buffalino crime family. He truly owned most of Pennsylvania, really from, you know, Pittston South. You know, Russell Buffalino had his hands into pretty much everything. And what was interesting about Russell was he was pretty nondescript. He was a kind of a small house, older car kind of guy. It was said that he cared for the people of the area. He's also said that he loved food and he'd maintain a small checking account with his wife that at really no points at over $300 to $500 in it. He knew how to operate. He knew that most of the stuff he could not put into a bank, and he was slowly building a fortune, and he had tentacles really everywhere. He was also making inroads in unions, which every good mobster needs to do. And this is where he starts making his connections into the Teamsters through his cousin, Bill Buffalino. He was out in Detroit and he started making inroads with Jimmy Hoffa, who was an up and comer and obviously making his run as kind of the Teamsters president once that president was out of the way. The thing about Bill Buffalino that's important to understand, the film makes him out to be like this goofy, like lawyer type. But in retrospect, he was a lawyer, but he was a mobster. From what I know, and according to a friend, Scott Bernstein, who, you know, has written a ton of books in Detroit, he actually told me that Buffalino had his button. He was definitely very connected. He was not like the Ray Romano character made him out to be in the film. And, you know, he represented Jimmy Hoffa. He was kind of his eyes and ears in Detroit. And Buffalino, in turn, Blackjack, realized that they needed to control Hoffa. That's where the real money was going to start flowing in from. And through his connections with Philly with Angelo Bruno, they kind of kept an eye on Hoffa, and they had he had his cousin, Bill Buffalino, doing it.
Perfect guy to do it, right? If you sit back and think about it, you got a guy who not only is, you know, a made guy, but a guy who is your cousin. And oh, by the way, he also happens to be a lawyer. I mean, all of the pieces are there for that one. So you probably couldn't get much better guy to keep an eye on Hoffa than Bill Buffalino.
Yeah, and by 1957, as we know, Hoffa would take control of the Teamsters, and his boy Bill Buffalino was right there. And, you know, Dave Beck stepped down, and this would lead to really a really profitable time for the mafia. Bill Buffalino eventually land Local 985. So, you know, by the late 50s, this was all funneling back to Russell Buffalino. It was said at one point that Russell was earning 5% for every loan he facilitated through the Teamsters Central Pension Fund. So you know, there was a lot of money being pumped back to Russell Bufalino and to other bosses up and down the East Coast. Bufalino, Russell's closest confidant, was an individual named William Medico, and he actually owned many legit businesses of his own. Obviously, any good boss has terrific emissaries around him to go out and make their own money as well. He would be kind of what you would think of as the high-end capo. By the late 50s, he and Russell were also starting to make inroads in another very profitable place, Cuba. Russell and Medico were seen spotted in Tampa with Tampa boss Sancho Traficante, and they also started being seen in Cuba. And, you know, obviously we know that Cuba would become a very big cash cow, at least the mob thought, because, as you know, Blackjack, at the time, it was really a paradise. It was a gambler paradise, basically. It was Las Vegas with a beach. And I think gangsters realized this is the new fertile ground. By this point, Bufalino was a very powerful man in the underworld, and it was perfect to be involved with Cuba, with his Teamster connections. He had all sorts of power, and it really just seemed like the world was his oyster. He had everything going for him. He was becoming one of the more powerful people in the mob, and then all things came to a halt, and we'll get to that in a second. But Bufalino was super powerful, you know, really in a matter of about, you know, 25 years.
Yeah, and I think that, Jeff, if you sit back and think about all the shows we've done, his is one of the more impressive rises, I would say, because of everything he had to deal with. I mean, you know, his parents dying tragically, the moving back and forth between Italy and America, you know, not really having a home, not having a family, and then, you know, kind of taking this different road. Like, he didn't take the normal path into Cosa Nostra that we've talked about so many times, you know, where, you know, you get hooked up with a guy who's kind of your mentor, and, you know, you start doing some low level stuff, you start running numbers, whatever. He's working in northeastern Pennsylvania, western New York. He's kind of carving his own thing out. And by this point, as you said, his setup is as good as any's in America, with significantly less heat than almost anybody else. I mean, the guy has really done an incredible job for himself at this point.
Yeah, 100% right. Obviously, though, as we know, in October of 1957, Albert Anastasia would be killed at the Park Sheraton Hotel. We know about that. Obviously, the main conspirators were Gambino, Vito Genovese. Genovese, by this point, is trying to take control of the entire Borgata, and he calls on a meeting, quote, to quell things after the Anastasia hit. He would call on Russell Bufalino to put it together. He basically wanted all the bosses out throughout the country to show up and, you know, have a meeting. And, you know, they would have a day or two where they would break bread and they would have a chat. And Joe Barbara felt like his place was perfect. It was a 58-acre parcel of land in rural Appalachian, New York. And he basically started getting everything together, started getting a bunch of food together. And yeah, as we know, I'm not going to go into what happened. We'll get into an episode on Appalachian in its own right. But ultimately, Appalachian would be raided by the police. Over 60 gangsters would ultimately be arrested. And what it would do mostly is it would put the purview into America that the mob was a real thing. And this started putting gangsters in the line of fire in the FBI. And this would set up a real problem for Bufalino, because this would start to call into question his citizenship. And that's the worst thing about Appalachian, Blackjack. It put it on the map that the mob was a legitimate enterprise. People were on the front page of papers. They have this huge trumpet of guys. And, you know, it really started to kind of come apart. By this point, you know, Bufalino was the leader of the Northeast mob, and Joe Barbara was sick in his own right. So he was going to be really in control of that entire area. And this was a bad look for the mob. And it was all because, you know, Vito Genovese had to kind of hold court over everybody else.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, as you said, we'll do an episode on Appalachian at some point. It more than deserves its own topic here, but yeah, I mean, this was the first time, I think, in American history where you couldn't argue anymore the mob doesn't exist, right? Because that's what they always used to say. There is no mafia. There's no such thing. At this point, when this happens and all these guys get busted, I don't think that argument's done. It's out the window. Like, this is now a real thing.
Yeah, and this would set up a problem because in December of 1957, the Immigration and Naturalization Service would file a motion of deportation against Bufalino, and they would claim that he was not born in Pittston, but in fact was born in Sicily, as we know. According to the book, The Quiet Don, the deportation officer would assign his case, reported the decision was based on a number of factors, including Bufalino's failure to establish good moral character, his lying under oath regarding his birthplace, and other false testimony, and his two fraudulent entries into the United States in 1956. So what would ultimately happen was the deportation order would start and he would appeal. He would be called in front of the U.S. Senate committee. And as we know, I mean, Bufalino wouldn't answer any questions. I mean, the only question he really answered was his wife's maiden name. That's pretty much all he answered. Every other one, he was taking the fifth. He was an old school guy. He wasn't going to talk. He had no interest in discussing anything. There was a lot going on for Bufalino from a deportation standpoint. But the good thing about deportation, Blackjack, is you can constantly fight it. You can appeal it. And interestingly enough, I kind of just ended on this as far as deportation. Russell Bufalino was never actually deported. He would ultimately exhaust all his appeals, but he would never get sent back to Italy because Italy wouldn't have him. They basically said, we're not accepting you into Italy. So he would never ultimately get deported. The good news for Bufalino was Jimmy Hoffa was now running the Teamsters. And Russell had met, you know, kind of capable people that were running the Teamsters. And he had a treasure trove of cash to fund different projects. This is also where he would start to get real close with a guy called Frank Sheeran. Frank was a union man from Philadelphia, and he had obviously met him many years before. And he connected through Bufalino, connected Sheeran to Hoffa. And this is where the very famous line, "I heard you paint houses," comes from. And again, I'm going to dispel some of the stuff that's said in that film. But Frank, I don't care what anybody says about Frank Sheeran. You could say he didn't kill Joe Gallo because he didn't. You could say he didn't kill Jimmy Hoffa because we don't know if he did. But the truth of the matter was Frank Sheeran was a powerful guy in unions. He was very connected with Jimmy Hoffa, and he was basically Hoffa's ears after Bill Bufalino. So things are going well for the most part for, you know, Russell Bufalino. The move was now in Cuba, though, with Meyer Lansky, and he knew that for years, you know, Cuba was the next fertile ground. The problem was there was a young revolutionary, Fidel Castro, trying to take over, and the mob knew that was going to be bad news. The United States government also knew that as well. It's funny, Blackjack, because when we look back, it's not really funny, but when we look back on Cuba, we have to also ultimately kind of say it's a shame that the mob never succeeded in getting what they wanted in Cuba, because it would have been a lot nicer place if Castro would have just been taken out.
I mean, no question about it, right? I mean, the mob was interested in Cuba for making money because they saw the profit potential the same way they did in Las Vegas. Fidel Castro came into Cuba and just started nationalizing everything he could get his hands on for his own personal gain and controlling the people of that island. So, yeah, had the mob run Cuba, it would have been a much better place for the next 70 years.
Yeah, and, you know, ultimately Castro would continue to make inroads and, you know, would ultimately take over. And this would be a big problem for the United States, as we know, with some of the different things that are going on in history. According to The Quiet Don, a terrific book written about Bufalino, and this is kind of commonly known, Jimmy Hoffa is contacted by the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency, about Castro. They wanted him eliminated. And they would basically say to Hoffa, let's try to connect us with the right people. And the right people would have been Bufalino, Johnny Roselli, and Sam Giancana in Chicago, and then Trafficante and Marcello in Tampa and New Orleans. They would tell Bufalino basically that he had money. These guys had money in Cuba that they couldn't get to because obviously Castro was there and he had outlawed gambling and all this different stuff. So they had money kind of there. And they would promise that if he could take care of Castro, they could uncover and recover the money for him. Cuba ultimately would topple and things would fall through. This would end up never not happening because Castro would lead a 50-year kind of run with communism in Cuba, and it would never be the same place. And it's really, again, kind of a shame because, yeah, you know, it's really rare that we ever think that the mob's going to ever save somewhere, but the mob truly would have saved Cuba if they would have been successful in killing Fidel Castro. It's a shame that it never happened, as I've said. Another problem would arise. JFK would get elected, but that would mean that RFK would begin his assault on the mob. And as we know, Blackshirt, there was no one that hated something more than RFK hated the mob.
Bobby Kennedy did not like the mafia.
Yeah, he would begin 24-hour surveillance on pretty much every major mob figure in America. And, you know, the problem that Russell would have is, like other mobsters like Meyer Lansky, he got crushed in Cuba. I mean, he lost all his money, and most of his money was in Cuba and or fighting deportation. So, you know, while he was making a ton, I mean, Cuba really wiped some of these guys out. Plus, he had to deal with, you know, 24-hour surveillance on his ass and getting jammed up by the feds. This is where he would make a pretty good inroad. He would have gumadas his entire life, and his probably his most important good and bad gumada was Jane Collins. She was a well-to-do woman that was married to a very rich individual, and he would actually take her as his gumada, and she would actually help him with cash injections when he needed it. And this is where in 1963, kind of an interesting meeting would happen. The FBI would contend, Blackjack, that in 1963, Russell Bufalino would make a phone call into Mexico. He would then contact directly Frank Sheeran, and Frank would be told to take a bag and to not look in the bag to friends in Baltimore. JFK would be killed 3 days later. And many would contend that the guns that Sheeran supposedly gave to people in Baltimore would find their way to the hands of Mr. Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, we don't know if that's true, but according to Sheeran, he would say that, you know, whether you believe him or not, he would say that, you know, Bufalino was, quote, elated after the fact when Kennedy was killed. And we remember Jimmy Hoffa was very happy as well. If you remember in the film, they had the flag at half staff, Blackjack, and Hoffa said, fuck that, put it back to high staff. We're not doing that here.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that most guys who were involved in organized crime were probably happy to see JFK go. You know, do I necessarily believe that story about the guns and Oswald? Not really. But, you know, I think it's one of those things that Frank Sheeran embellishes a little bit in his older age.
Yes. Now, it could have been true. Obviously, it was an interesting turn of events how it all happened. But, you know, some of it can be a little much. This relationship with Jane Collins, though, would sever. And this would be another problem that Bufalino would have to deal with. She would ultimately flip. She decides she wanted to be a good woman again, and she flips and, you know, kind of goes against Bufalino, and he has to appeal deportation again. By the late 60s, Bufalino continues to rule. He has many illegal business, but he's obviously fighting, deportation. He's fighting a gumada that was out of control. And, you know, labor records are now his things. But as I said, he always had his hand kind of in everything. He also would have Sheeran pretty invested in what Jimmy Hoffa was doing. And, you know, things are going well on that front. In 1969, though, Jimmy Hoffa would have to go to prison. And this would kind of signal and begin kind of the end for the Jimmy Hoffa experiment. You know, obviously, Jimmy Hoffa was a bit of a whiner, a complainer, kind of an annoyance. You know, he always kind of had that feel, Blackjack, of just like an annoying little fuck, right? Like he wanted things his way, had to have it. And that's why I thought Pacino did a great job as him in the film, because I think that's really how Hoffa was. He was just kind of this annoying guy that like was power hungry and needed control. And he was like a tryhard or like a, you know, just a tryhard all the time. Right.
I do. Yeah. I mean, Jimmy Hoffa was a guy who loved the spotlight, you know, he liked everything to be about him. And we've seen in this lifestyle, Jeff, how that often turns out for guys. Not well.
Right. And, you know, that's kind of what happened. The problem was Hoffa would go away and, you know, greener pastures would come. An individual named Frank Fitzsimmons would kind of take over control of the Teamsters. And the mob started realizing that he was probably more the guy for the job. He was more professional. He was a businessman. He had many connections to Richard Nixon. And by this point, Richard Nixon, you know, obviously, they wanted the support of the president, the Teamsters. They just kind of realized things flowed a lot smoother with Fitzsimmons over Jimmy Hoffa.
Yep.
And this was problematic because this is what kind of sucks about going to prison, Blackjack. It's kind of like when you have, for instance, when you, you know, and maybe some people don't know what this is like, but being Jeff Nadeau, I have these problems. I get a lot of beautiful women, right? It's almost like if I have a beautiful woman and I find out I have to go to prison, the likelihood of her staying with me is low. So I have to realize that life's going to go on without me. And that's exactly what happened. Jimmy Hoffa kind of just became the old girlfriend. And you kind of realize, you know what? He's kind of crazy. I can get way better. The grass is definitely greener on the other side. And Frank Fitzsimmons, it was realized that he just did a better job than Jimmy Hoffa was. He was kind of annoying and wouldn't get out of the way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing, right? Is like ultimately Hoffa was effective. He was annoying. He kind of rubbed people the wrong way. He was an egotistical guy. But then all of a sudden Fitzsimmons comes in and it's like, you know what? We're getting better results without any of the negative shit. Why do we need Jimmy Hoffa?
Right. And ultimately, interestingly enough, in 1971, Richard Nixon would actually commute Hoffa's sentence and he would commute it to time served. He would also then, once he got out, as a result of his resignation, he would be awarded almost $2 million in a termination benefit from the Retirement and Family Protection Plan. So the thought was, okay, he'll just go away quietly and go play with his grandkids and that'll be that. Well, that's not happening. He basically starts, going after Fitzsimmons and kind of trying to screw things up. Obviously, there were certain people in the mob that didn't like Hoffa anyway. Obviously, Tony Provenzano, who we know, he was a big union leader in New Jersey. Obviously, if you know anything about Detroit, there were certain people in Detroit that were starting to get sick and tired of Jimmy Hoffa. And, you know, Russell Bufalino kind of was the pragmatist in all this. He had a friendship with Hoffa and he kind of said to Hoffa, look, you kind of just need to get out of the way. Stay away, take your money and go and just, go back to normality. You're done with the union. He couldn't be involved with the union anyway. I mean, that was kind of against the stuff that he wasn't allowed to do. So he was kind of done, but Jimmy Hoffa didn't want to accept that. He just kept going after and going after and going after Frank Fitzsimmons. In 1963, though, on another front, Russell Bufalino would actually exhaust most of his appeals. He would start to get his orders in affair, basically kind of connecting himself with people that would start taking over some of his operations. But as I said, in 1963, it was realized that Italy wouldn't have him. So the stay of deportation was actually held up. This is also when Stefano Magadino would die. And, Russell Bufalino was kind of working on a couple different fronts. He was controlling Northeast Pennsylvania, but he also would kind of do some things up in Buffalo and kind of help with the power move there to kind of help the surge in power of people kind of jumping into the vacuum. And there was actually a rumor, Blackjack, I've never been actually able to really, whether I believe this or not, but there was also a time in the early 70s when Tommy Oboli was killed, that it was actually rumored that Bufalino, who had many ties with the Genovese crime family, it was actually talked about that he was the street boss at one time of the Genovese crime family. That's actually been, that's actually been readily talked about. Kind of right within the power move from, Salerno kind of taking over street operations. He was definitely very connected with people, really from the 40s in the Genovese family. They were always very much in lockstep. But by the mid 70s, the big problem that Bufalino has is Jimmy Hoffa. He starts to do some really outlandish things. And Blackjack, as we know, what happens to people that don't follow rules?
You don't last very long.
No. And by this point, Hoffa has these grand inquisitions that he's going to seize the presidency of the Teamsters again. And, Bufalino's behind the scenes basically trying to say, give him some more chances. Don't get rid of him yet. Let me kind of act as kind of the overseer here. He was telling Frank Sheeran, who was kind of the eyes and ears to Hoffa, look, get this fucking guy in line. There's no other opportunities. He has to either do what we say or something bad's going to happen to him. And he's also kind of concerning to some of the Teamsters' interest, because as we know, by this point, the Teamsters is making and really the funding for the casinos in Las Vegas. So this was all a major problem. And the big cog on all this was Jimmy Hoffa. That would set up a meeting in Philadelphia to finally try and get Hoffa to settle down. It would involve Frank Sheeran, Buffalino, different members from New York, and Angelo Bruno as well. According to the book, The Quiet Down, which I got some good information from, there would be a quote that Buffalino would basically tell Hoffa, quote, "It would be in your best interest and for everyone concerned if you reconsidered your position." That's basically what was told to Hoffa. And, you know, it was basically get down or lay down. If you're not going to back off, I can't control what happens to you anymore.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of – you put people in a position where they don't have a choice anymore, right? And we've talked about this with so many guys. It amazes me, Jeff, that so many guys get themselves into these positions where they can't see the handwriting on the wall, right? Like, if you're Jimmy Hoffa, you said it a few minutes ago, take your millions of dollars, go play with your grandkids and shut up, right? Instead, you push people and you force their hand, and ultimately, you know, you wind up rumored to be buried underneath the Meadowlands.
Yeah, and this is what kind of would set it up. You know, certain mob figures, particularly in Detroit, Anthony Giacalone, people like that, they were starting to position themselves kind of as mediators between Jimmy Hoffa and his main kind of rival in all this, Tony Provenzano, who wanted him out of the way. He was sick and tired of him. The Giacalones would make multiple visits to Hoffa's home, and Hoffa's son would actually say at one point, quote, "Dad was pushing hard to get back in office. I was increasingly afraid that the mob would do something about this." And he was convinced, his son, that the peace meetings were really just kind of settling and setting him up to kind of be hit ultimately. And look, that's ultimately what would happen. In August 1st, 1965, they would kind of use the facade that they were going to Bill Buffalino's daughter's wedding up in Detroit. And they would set a meeting up. And it's actually one of the things about the film that were correct was the whole driving up with their wives and that sort of thing. That all did actually happen. Ultimately, through, I believe, Frank Sheeran, I think that's the only way Hoffa agrees to this. He and Buffalino set up a meeting where they meet Hoffa, not Buffalino, but, you know, Frank Sheeran, Chucky O'Brien, some of the people from Pro's crew. They set up a meeting at a place called the Marcus Red Fox in Bloomfield Township, Michigan, which is a suburb of Detroit. There would be Tony Giacalone and some of the other people involved. And this is ultimately where Jimmy Hoffa would disappear. Now, I'm going to, in the next minute or two, give you my thought as to what actually happened. I'm in very much belief that they picked him up just like they did in the film at about, you know, what was it, 1:30 p.m., I believe that his, you know, adopted son was in the car. He was the one driving. I think Frank Sheeran was ultimately there as well. They take him to basically a home, the home that we know they took him to. Do I believe Frank Sheeran killed him? No, I don't. And I have it on good authority that he didn't do that. What do I think happened to his body? I think it's pretty simple. I think they took him to a trash company that they owned in the Detroit area. I think they incinerated his body. And I think, as I've said before, I think he's on someone's mantle somewhere. I really do. I don't think he's buried anywhere. He wasn't thrown in an ocean. He wasn't taken to New York Giants Stadium. It just didn't happen. I think the mob does things easy most of the time. And on a hit like this, you're not going to drive the body from Detroit to New Jersey. It just never happened. I think all of this is just content for news companies now. It's great to wonder where he is. I think if you know anything about mob history, I think it's pretty clear. Jimmy Hoffa is likely, again, ashes on someone's mantle.
Yeah, I mean, you're probably right. I mean, if you sit back and think about it, when you say it out loud, the idea of driving a dead body from Michigan to New Jersey doesn't make a hell of a lot of sense. It increases your exposure a great deal. So, yeah, Murphy's Law, maybe? The simplest conclusion is usually the right one.
Exactly.
I think that's probably right. I mean, you know, what you said about Sheeran obviously had to be involved because it's the only way Hoffa was going to be comfortable, but I'm with you. I don't think Frank Sheeran pulled the trigger. And yeah, I mean, they had a lot of different ways they could have handled this in the Detroit area. You know, the idea that Jimmy Hoffa is like either still alive or was alive recently or was buried under a football stadium is kind of farcical.
Yeah, 100%. And look, as we know, ultimately no one was ever brought to justice for killing Jimmy Hoffa. No one ever talked, even Frank Sheeran late in his life. And he would obviously say he did it, but he would never implicate anyone. No one involved. And look, everyone involved in this case is dead, as far as I know. You know, whether it was Sally Bugs Bergoglio or Tony Jack or whoever, all these people are dead. And quite honestly, we'll never know what truly happened. But at any rate, will it really change much? No. I mean, they're never going to know anyway. But again, it's just content for a lot of people. But obviously, Buffalino would lose a friend, but he had to go. And it was that simple. On October 27, 1976, Russell Buffalino would actually be arrested. This would be the first time, really, he'd been arrested. He would be arrested on charges of extortion after he threatened to kill a individual called Jack Napoli, who failed to pay a $25,000 debt to a jeweler that he knew. And this Napoli was in the witness protection program. So this would ultimately jam Russell up. He would try to kind of get his things in order and kind of throw people in as kind of the acting boss for him. He would promote his brother-in-law, Edward Chiandra, to acting boss and remove himself from day-to-day operations. And by this point, his driver, Big Billy D'Elia, was actually starting to make some inroads as well. In 1978, Russell Buffalino would be convicted of extortion and sentenced to 4 years in prison. He'd serve about 3 years in the feds. By the time he got out in May of 1981, he would actually be indicted again, this time for trying to kill Jack Napoli. He actually went to an individual called Jimmy the Weasel Fratiano, who was actually an Ohio mobster who was out in LA at this point. He would go to Fratiano and ask him to kill Napoli. He would get 10 years because Fratiano was wired up as well. And this would be kind of the last time, you know, Russell Buffalino would kind of be in power. He would head to Leavenworth and serve his time. The film says that Buffalino dies in prison. That's not true. He would actually be released in 1989, and he would turn the family completely over to Bill D'Elia, who up until the 2000s was actually the boss of the family. He would ultimately cooperate against some business people in that area, and that family is now defunct. There is no Northeast Mob anymore. Bill D'Elia is still alive, as far as I know. Russell Buffalino would actually die, though, on February 25th, 1994, of natural causes in his home in Kingston, Pennsylvania. He was 90 years old. So really, after the Hoffa hit, things never really were the same for Buffalino. He obviously had a hand in that. Do I think he was the main decision maker? No. But when we look back on Russell Buffalino, we have to look at the success that he had, the power that he drew, the fact that at one point he may have been one of the more powerful people in the entire country. The feds came to him to kill people. Okay, that's kind of the guy that he was dealing with. And that's kind of the grand scheme and scope of the people we talk about. You know, obviously people like John Gotti or Casso or some of these people, look, they're gangsters for sure. Blackjack, these are real gangsters. These guys that literally shaped this country from a criminal standpoint. People like Buffalino, who really had tons of money, tons of power, tons of control, tons of connections. They were making true inroads in crime. And these were the top level guys.
Yeah, you're not wrong. I mean, obviously these were guys who, you know, who are a huge part of the fabric of what the American Mafia became. You know, the thing that I'll go back to about Buffalino is that I find so, you know, impressive about him. And again, the disclaimer, I'm not putting him on a pedestal. I'm not saying he's a great man. He was a criminal. I understand that. But I can still give someone credit for creating a life for themselves where, I mean, so many people would have really struggled with that. I mean, if you try to put yourself in Russell Buffalino's shoes, you know, at the time when he was you know, born in the early part of the 20th century, losing both parents as a small child, going back and forth between these two countries, ultimately Italy just declaring him persona non grata. I mean, he was a man without a country, Jeff. I mean, he literally was a man without a country and a man without a family, and yet he still managed to carve out a very successful life for himself and ultimately didn't do a ton of time in prison. You know, I think Russell Bufalino is in a lot of ways the embodiment of the American dream.
Yeah. I mean, obviously he took it to kind of a different way and became a criminal, but again, very business savvy, very business related, obviously had a ton of legit businesses, was very well off, did really well. But, you know, obviously as for many of these mob guys in the early 60s, Cuba really did some of these guys in. Kind of an interesting story as we wrap up Russell Bufalino. In 1972, Russell Bufalino was actually involved with some Godfather stuff. Singer Al Martino had the role of Johnny Fontaine in The Godfather, and that would actually be taken from him and given to another individual called Vic Damone. Martino, who was the godson of Bufalino, would go and complain, and Bufalino would actually orchestrate kind of leaning on Francis Ford Coppola to give Martino the part. And it would actually work because Damone actually ended up losing the role, and ultimately Johnny Fontaine was played by Al Martino. And it was said that, you know, Bufalino actually really enjoyed the film. I have heard certain people say that some of Vito Corleone is based on Bufalino. Obviously, I don't, you know, it's really just an opinion, but I have heard people bring that up. But, you know, it's interesting because we go back and we look at the film, The Irishman, and Bufalino had a huge role in the film. I thought Pesci did a great job as Bufalino. But, you know, Blackjack, I don't think I've ever told anyone this, but I'll tell you it now. You know, the reason I started the sit down was actually related to The Irishman, right?
No.
So the last 30 minutes of the film, I think you made the case. I think it's one of the best parts of any mob movie ever made. I thought the last 30 minutes were incredibly, incredibly good because they really just orchestrated, I think, why this show is important, because Frank Sheeran realizes that in the film that all the things that he did in his life, all the people he killed, all the people he ostracized, his family, the fact that he threw away his kids, basically, for the mob, he ultimately realizes at the end that it was all for nothing and that no one knew the fuck he was. And I think the reason the show was created in a way was because most people don't know the people we're talking about, and we have to almost bring them back into who they are. We need to, though, to highlight who these people are. They're bad people that have basically ostracized everyone in their life for their own financial gain, basically. And they end up ostracizing not only their family, but their communities as well. And I just thought the movie was brilliant at the end because it really just kind of showed that, you know, time just moves. And by today's day, you know, most people don't know who the fuck Jimmy Hoffa was. They don't know who Russell Bufalino. Like, that's the thing about this genre. And, you know, people like us know who he is, but I don't know. It's just kind of a random thing to think about. Look at all the things Bufalino did. Now he's just a distant memory. Those guys were has-beens. And, you know, it just kind of orchestrates the mob and what they are. They're violent criminals who end up fading away into relative anonymity, frankly.
Yeah, it's an interesting way to look at it. You know, I mean, I think you're obviously right about the end of The Irishman. It kind of does give you that look into the mirror a little bit.
It's kind of haunting getting old, isn't it?
A little bit about our own lives, right? Like that, you know, the world goes on, you know, no matter who's here to see it and who's not. So, yeah, thanks for the super depressing end note, Jeff. But, you know, yeah, I the point is well taken.
Yeah, and I won't end on that note, but I just think the ending is really, really well done. Obviously, the film isn't entirely accurate, as we know, but yeah, so that's that for Russell Bufalino. As I said, the Northeast Pennsylvania mob is defunct. There's really nothing left of it. And, you know, it's one of those defunct crime families at this point. So that's that. Obviously, a pretty interesting episode. Russell Bufalino on the sit down. Some of the good info I got from this show was from that book, The Quiet Don. Very well written book by Matt Birkbeck. A really good book if you're ever looking for a good mob novel. We'll be back next week with another great episode. As I've said many times, please support our sponsors. And please check us out on Twitter at the Sit Down 7. If you're just finding the show and you haven't done it yet, make sure you give us 5 stars, review it, let us know what you think. And, you know, communicate with us online. Check us out on YouTube as well. Blackjack, I'm up over 6,000 followers on YouTube. So go check us out on there. I do some interviews and some other cool little shorts about mobsters. So check that out. We'll be back next week in another episode. Blackjack, I know you're traveling right now. What do you got going on? What are you up to?
I'm in Indianapolis right now trying to close a deal for BTV. Make sure everyone goes and follows us at BTV Bets. Check us out at betterthanvegas.com. We're giving away free money every week, different contests and stuff. We're going to have some great content coming up this summer. So everyone stay tuned.
For anyone that doesn't know, Blackjack and I are both in the sports betting community. He has Better Than Vegas. And I urge, if you're a gambler, check it out. As he said, he's giving away money. There's all sorts of stuff going on over there. So check that out. We'll be back next week with another great episode of The Sit Down. We thank you for being here. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.